Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky discussing Bay Area Theater. My guest is Tony Taccone, the artistic director of Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. Berkeley Rep's new season begins with an audience with Meow Meow.
Meow Meow.
That opens on Friday, September 12th, and runs through October 19th. We're going to talk about that play. We're going to talk about the upcoming season. I'm going to ask Tony Taccone questions about the past season, including IHO, the Tony Kushner show, and a little bit about one of the projects that Berkeley Rep works on, which is called The Ground Floor. Let's start, Tony Taccone, with an audience with Meow Meow. Who is this person? It's a postmodern performer. What is this?
Meow Meow is a combination of Liza Minnelli and Lucille Ball. If you can put those two people together, you get a real sense of the sort of spectrum of her talent. She's a great comedian, a tremendous singer. She's an internationally renowned cabaret singer. But she's done a lot of theater. She's from Australia. She's created this persona of Meow Meow, which is a very exotic diva, certainly just a character that she's managed to sort of combine cabaret traditional singing with a kind of comic assault that is both really endearing and a little dangerous. I mean, she goes into the audience a lot. She works with the audience a lot. She gets the audience to do things that they would never imagine that they would do. I think she's an extraordinarily talented woman. I mean, and by the way, in her other life, she also speaks four languages and is a lawyer and those kinds of things too. So she's an amazing person.
Is this an actual play then?
Emma Rice, who directed The Wild Bride, and Tristan Isolde, you know, our wonderful colleague from Knee High in England, has worked with Meow on some plays. She told me about this creature called Meow Meow and said, you got to see her. And so I flew up to Portland, Oregon, where she was performing in a concert with the Auckland Symphony Orchestra. And what was so great about that was that the audience, you know, was made up of people who were subscribers to the, you know, Oregon Symphony, not Meow Meow fans. She slayed them. She slayed every single person in that audience, which was about a 2,000-seat house. And people who hadn't heard of her were won over by her. So what we're doing is we're taking the foundation of the work, you know, that she's created over the last 6 or 7 years, and we're making it into a dramatic evening. Emma had a seminal role in doing that. Dramaturg Robert Egan had a seminal role in doing that. So we're structuring an event where you see her persona in a dramatic situation change over the course of the evening. We're basically taking her material and making a play out of it.
You found out about her because Emma Rice just spoke with you and mentioned this incredible woman, and you had not heard of her?
I had heard about her actually once from David Binder, who's a producer in New York, who just did Hedwig and The Angry Inch. About 3 or 4 years ago, he said, have you heard of Meow Meow? And I, like everybody else, I'm like, what? What is that? He said, she's this amazing performer, and you got to get to know her. I looked up her website, and I checked her out, and I saw the pictures, and I heard the voice, but that was my only contact. And then David actually tried to get her to do a show in New York. One thing led to another. Schedules didn't work out. And long story short, she's come back into the fold under the aegis of this play.
This is a little bit different from what you've been doing. It seems like you've been stretching the bounds of theater in the past couple of years.
You know, in that sense, it's very much the same about what we've been doing. I've been accused of not doing plays anymore, which is, I take exception to that, of course, but I think we are involved in a fairly serious experiment of expanding the definition of what a play is. With the hybridization of the art form, there's so many different artists of different persuasions and expertise that are, you know, now interested in doing theater. We started this process, I think, really with Stu in a conscious way with Passing Strange. You know, where we took a performer who didn't have any theater experience. We just saw his band and how he told stories on stage and went, that guy could write a musical. So ever since then, we've made a conscious attempt. And The Ground Floor, which you mentioned in your opening remarks, Ground Floor is our incubation for new work. It's the program by which we bring new talent, writers that we both know and don't know, into a program, the highlight of which is a one-month residency in June, usually. This year we had 19 different projects come into that with about 80 artists. Fantastic program. It is a absolutely fantastic, wonderful project. And it's changed the culture of Berkeley rap. It's restored our sense, I think, of mission in a way where we are here as a major regional nonprofit organization to support the art form, to use every one of our resources to find ways to create safe homes for artists. And so the ground floor does that. Meow will have come through that, as will numbers of other of our projects.
Tony Taccone, we'll get into that a little bit more, because one of the ground floor shows is actually coming to Berkeley Rep next season. But this brings up a question I've noticed in talking to many of the artistic directors around here. There's more of an emphasis at each place, each company, on new work, on creating world premieres that I don't recall in the past. It may have to do with the changing art form, but I'm wondering if it also has to do with the fact that maybe there aren't that many great plays that you're hearing about.
I don't think so. I don't think that's it. You know, about 13, 14 years ago, I started to feel that the revolutionary agenda that was at the heart of the founding of the regional theater movement, which was in the late 50s, early 60s, was based upon a menu, if you will, that was slightly dated. In other words, it used to be, if you did a six-play season, five of the plays were from the classical canon, which meant European classics, and a play from New York, and a hit from New York. That's how you set it up. That was your formula. You know, I think after a couple of generations of people being excited and exposed to that, it started to feel that the list of classical plays that people were talking about was about 50 to 75 plays that were just familiar titles that had, you know, aspired to the category of greatness, right? I'm being reductive here, but not by much. And I thought, well, you know, I've seen Midsummer Night's Dream now 12 times. And it's a great, great play. But my interest in it has lessened over the years. I'm not as excited to see it as I once was, because I've seen great productions of it and I want to see something else. So I started to feel that we were uniquely positioned at Berkeley to alter the menu, because I felt like with where we were, both geographically and culturally, the Bay Area is well known for having a interested, engaged audience, people who are not afraid to think in metaphor, not afraid to take risks in lots of parts of their lives. And I felt like we were uniquely positioned if we could introduce material that was of high quality and produce it at a level that was very well respected, that we had an opportunity to sort of change the menu a little bit. And so I set out to do that. We set out as an organization to consciously do that. And not that we don't like classical plays. We're doing Tartuffe next year in a brilliant production of that play. Brilliant. And I think any theater company worth its salt has got to measure itself against the greatest plays of all time. They're the greatest for a reason. And even though each generation redefines what constitutes greatness, I think you can say pretty confidently that King Lear is a pretty good play.
Right.
So anyway, I do think we have changed our diet, so to speak. I think we've become more interested in new work. I think a lot of companies have picked up on that as well. I think people are workshopping plays a lot more. And I do think this also happens to be a golden age for playwriting. I would disagree with anybody who thinks that we can't find really good plays. I think we find a lot of great plays. And we've managed to introduce a few of them to our audience, and I'm very happy to be a part of that.
Is it also the case that, you know, something I've noticed at a lot of these theater companies, a little less at Berkeley Rep, that the crowd seems to be older, and maybe younger people want something different too. So if you're going to bring younger people into the mix, you have to expand.
Well, I'm happy to say that our under 30 program has done fantastically well. I think a good 25% of our single ticket buyers are now under 30 years old, which is great. And so I do think that we've made a concerted effort to try to embrace younger people. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Younger people speak a different vernacular. Their understanding and assumptions about the world are not the same as their parents or grandparents. Some of them are, but some of them aren't. And I think that younger writers share a sensibility. I mean, we have interesting audiences here. There's a pretty good mix. And there are many, many plays that we do where you can literally feel the audience arguing with itself, with each other. Most apparently in comedies, right? Because comedies are much more controversial in my mind than dramas are. Because, you know, if you're sitting next to a person who's laughing raucously at things you don't find funny at all, you think, well, either this person is out of it, or I'm out of it, or what's going on? And I don't think that's just about taste. I think it's about values in some ways. I mean, we did The Pillow Man, for example. When you do plays like that that are darkly comic, then what people are laughing, what people find funny, can be offensive to, you know, people who don't share those values, find it to be threatening and insulting. And so I love producing work that actually creates an argument, in, you know, like in the audience somewhat.
Well, I don't want to get too far afield on this, but when I saw Iho, my friend and I were laughing hysterically. We looked across, and there was one couple with their hands folded, not saying a word. And after Act One, they didn't come back.
Yeah, right. The great thing for me about Iho, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with the Key to the Scriptures. That's the full title of the play. Tony wisely gave it the acronym IHO. Actually, his husband did, but we all are able to call it that. So Kushner, you know, Kushner's play is over 3.5 hours long, and I think everybody was a little daunted by that fact in terms of just the staff and the cast. The cast went out there, and I have to tell you, the overwhelming feeling of that audience was they were there for the whole thing. They really enjoyed the whole thing. They followed it very intensely. They were engaged with it. They found the ambition of the play, at the very least, enormously exciting. Kushner's a singular voice, you know, and he obviously has a following here. Yeah, but there were people who went like, oh, my God, I'm out. I'm out of this.
Tony Taccone, let's talk about a few of the other plays that are coming up. After that is another strange hybrid, seems to be a hybrid. It's called Party People by a group called Universes, a New York-based theater collective. The show also played in Ashland, and it's about a meeting between the Panthers and the Young Lords.
Well, premise of the play, the dramatic situation is that it is a bit of a reunion between people who were in the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords at an installation, a photographic installation that's been created by these two younger guys. That is the landscape for a very combustible and exciting dialogue. Universes is made up of three folks. They are great, boisterous, smart, talented theater artists who came out of the spoken word movement in New York and then started creating theater pieces. They sing beautifully. They move great. So their pieces are filled with a kind of performance energy that's very viscerally exciting. It was done in Ashland in a very different incarnation, but it was very successful in Ashland. A lot of people, some of your audience members may have seen it up there. You know, my feeling is that if there's any theater in the United States that's predisposed to want to do a play about the Black Panther Party, it's Berkeley Rep. It happened here. Many, many of the people who Universe has interviewed over the past 2 years, and they interviewed many people, you know, are from here. I imagine an opening night will be filled with characters who you're going to see on stage in some form or another. Now, no one is called by name. It's a fictitious documentary, if you will. But certainly all the stories are inspired and told by real folks. And the play deals with the legacy of the past, with the meaning of the past, people's attempt to try to derive significance and a sense of historical authenticity and truth. It's a complicated story. We've done a lot of work, though, to make the storylines more dynamic and to make them more character-based. For those people who did see the National, while they will recognize the energy of the piece, they won't recognize the storylines that much. So I feel really excited about it. I think it's going to be very exciting.
Next show on the schedule there is Red Hot Patriot, The Kick-Ass Wit of Molly Ivins with Kathleen Turner. And that came from Broadway, and I'd like to interview her because I knew Molly.
Yeah. Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. What a spitfire she was. She's the best thing. I mean, obviously, Molly Ivins is a character for the ages. How she managed to even live in Texas, I have no idea, honestly. I mean,
she loved it.
Yeah, she did. Well, she was the real thing. You know,
well, she was in Austin, and Austin is like the Berkeley of Texas.
Right, it is, yeah. It is. But, you know, obviously she made a mini career by going after George W. Bush for all those years. Although I think her most famous quote is the Pat Buchanan. After the Pat Buchanan gave his speech to the Republican Party, she's famously quoted that, "I'm sure it sounded better in the original German."
Now, I just remember talking to her, and I think it was the last time I talked to her. Bush was president, and she just said, "You know, you people in Berkeley, you have no sense of humor. Come on, politics is fun."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she had a different attitude, but she thought we all were, and we are, we're so self-absorbed with the seriousness of what we think and how we feel that, you know, we sometimes can't put our flags down. But she kind of looked at the whole thing as a kind of pageant, you know, a pageant on the greatest stage in the world. And so she also felt very lucky to have this particular role of, like, court scribe / court jester, you know. I think Kathleen Turner is a really formidable, passionate presence on stage. She clearly loved Molly Ivins. I mean, she has a commitment to the material. She sees herself, I think, in some ways as a bit of an activist. By doing this play, I think she's sort of, if you will, spreading the word a little bit, just in terms of the searing intelligence that's behind the, you know, the language and barbs. I mean, she's, her intention is to sort of celebrate the responsibility she felt as a civilian, you know, commenting on society's ills. I think Kathleen marries her own persona and her own intentions with that.
How did you manage to get the play?
Fortunately, a good friend of mine directed it, David Esbjornsson, who was one of the guys who worked on the original Angels in America over at the Eureka. I've known David forever. David directed it. It was done at the Geffen in L.A., and he called me and said, you know, you better get down here to see this thing because I think it's worthy. And we tried to bring it up a couple of years ago, but the schedules just didn't work out. And then they came back to us last year and said, hey, we're free now. And I said, okay, let's do it.
X's and O's, A Gridiron Love Story, is a show that came out of the ground floor.
KJ Sanchez, who is creating the project with Jenny Mersain. Jenny's dad used to play for the Packers, and Jenny and KJ were friends, and they happened to be meeting up at a party, and Jenny mentioned something about football. KJ happened to be a huge football fan. KJ runs her own company, which does basically docudramas of sorts, they're fictional docudramas, and so she had just completed this piece about vets returning from Afghanistan, which was very successful. I loved it. I read it, and I thought it was terrific. They knew that I was a sports fan. So once they conjured up this idea of maybe doing a play about this, they called me up and said, hey, we have this idea about doing a piece, you know, catalyzed by this notion of what's going on with football and the head trauma issues and the concussion issues that are surrounding the NFL, which is a $9 billion a year enterprise, and trying to make a more personal and interesting piece of theater that both kind of understood what it is about this particular moment of history that's creating this dynamic, this weird dynamic of, you know, modern gladiators, if you will, in the service of this fantastical spectacle, which is in a capitalist economy, you know, with all of its contradictions. I said yes. So we commissioned the project. Anything that we commission goes through the ground floor. So, yeah, it did go through the ground floor this summer. We had a great workshop, 2 weeks worked on. The first week was just text. The second week, we had actors in there running around. It follows former players grappling in different ways with head issues. It follows families, the offspring of three players who killed themselves. In the killing of themselves, started to understand the nature of head injuries. It also, though, one of the seminal things about it that KJ is exploring is, and the other spine of it is fans who love the game, and she loves football, KJ does, and so her attempt is to try to see both the beauty and the joy and the goodness, if you will, of sport and of this particular sport and the excesses of what that love can kind of lead to.
Tartuffe, if I recall correctly, did that come here as Theater de June Lune?
No, but you're right in the sense that some of the principal members of June Lune are attached to Tartuffe. Dominique Saran, the director, Steve Epp, who's been here many times, both with June Lune shows and with other folks. and some of the other members of Juneland are coming back. Tartuffe was just on the South Coast in the same version. It is absolutely beautiful. What Dominique is so good at with his work on Molière is exploring the deep melancholy and sometimes dark underbelly of the comedy. And they live side by side. So the plays are both hilarious and scary. And he's amazing that way. And he and Steve have this language that they've developed over this material, which is really singular and also beautiful. I mean, Dominique is he's French. You know, everything has to have sort of like a beautiful punctuation to it. You know, how the wrist falls, how the hair blows away, how the people glide and move on stage, the color schemes. It's all part of a palette that's very, very haunting and riveting and irresistible. So really happy to bring that back.
And you're in constant touch with them, so you just find out what's going on and they
Yeah, I mean, we're in constant touch. I think I've been in constant touch with about 300 artists. I don't talk to them every week. Right. But I think we keep tabs on people who we feel are deeply, deeply talented and who we want to have come back. And then also try to keep our ear to the ground for everybody new who's got something to offer.
Tony Taccone, the next is Terrell Albert McRaney's latest play, Head of Passes, and the brother-sister plays, and a couple other plays of his, I think, have played in the Bay Area.
Well, the brother's size was here. There was a trilogy that was done. ACT, Marin, and Magic all did a kind of celebration of his work in this trilogy, and they each took one play, which was exciting. I'm sorry we couldn't be part of that. Terrell is somebody who we've commissioned a number of years ago, and he accepted the commission, then he got overloaded. He just said, you know what, I have so many of these things, and I have writer's block now. And so we basically said, you know what, whenever you're ready. The play that we're doing with him, Head of Passes, Tina Landau, who is the director, I'm very excited to have her at Berkeley Rep. She's never worked here. She is really talented. She's a Steppenwolf company member. She directed this play in its premiere form at Steppenwolf. Now, it's hard to get your plays done a second time. One of the problems of a culture that's so focused on premieres is it tends to discard after they've opened, when in fact they have another round to go. My friend Oscar Eustace, who runs The Public, who I used to work with at the Eureka, called me, had seen it, said, look, we should do this play again. It's a beautiful play. It's got another round to go. There's some problems. Terrell knows what they are. He wants to work on them again. I read the play, obviously. Its initial inspiration was the Book of Job. I mean, Terrell is religious in some ways. He has faith. I wouldn't want to say it's a formally dogmatized, but he definitely has faith. And he was trying to write a play about a woman who loses everything in a very short amount of time. And the very foundation of her sense of self is really shaken. And so it becomes a confrontation with much, much bigger issues about belief and about sanctity. And is it possible to have reverence for a world with so much suffering? He's trying to write about that for a secular audience, an audience that may not believe in any kind of religion at all, which I suspect a significant portion of my audience falls into that category. And he's a beautiful writer. He knew his problems were in the second act, and we agreed, and so we're going to have a workshop of that play in the ground floor, and then we're going to do that in the spring.
And the final play is something that was on Broadway called One Man, Two Governors. James Corden won a Tony for it.
He did, and he gave a spectacular performance. And that's always a little daunting when you have, you know, that as an image for people to compare to. But we have secured the services of Dan Donahue, who is an amazing actor. His comic chops are off the charts, and so I'm really excited. And David Ivers, who's co-artistic director of Utah Shakespeare, is coming to do it, and he's a wonderful comic artist himself. And so I'm very excited to bring that to the Bay Area. It's just a scathingly funny show. It's in the spirit of a comedy show reset in Britain in a bit more of a modern context. It's got a band in it, and it's just a wild slapstick harlequin goes crazy kind of thing.
And it's the story of a man with two corporate bosses?
Yeah, it's the classic thing where you have a guy who's stuck between two different employers trying to satisfy both agendas, which are antithetical to each other, and he's running back and forth and pretending he's this with that person and that with the other person, and comic melee ensues, and it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Tony Taccone, let's talk a little about the previous season. A minute ago, you talked about shows often don't get a second chance. There was one world premiere there, The House That Will Not Stand. Mm-hmm. Is that going on from there?
It went on from here to go to Yale, Yale Rep in New Haven. There's a lot of folks interested in it right now. Marcus Garley has so many shows going on now. He did 9 shows of his were done last year on the United States. I mean, that's, I never even heard of that. I mean, I don't know if Shakespeare had 9 of his plays done at one time, but, I mean, in his lifetime. I have every hope that that show will go on somewhere else.
Talk a little bit more about Iho in a moment, but the season started with No Man's Land. What was it like hanging out with Patrick Stewart, Billy Crudup, Shuler Hensley, and Ian McKellen?
In a word, inspiring. You know, you never know when you meet famous people if they're going to sort of live up to your own idealized version of who they are or who you or romanticized notions of who they might be. But I'm telling you, these guys, they were the real deal. I'll tell you one little story. They had a preview week, which was, you know, they had on a Wednesday night, they had a double day on Thursday. That means there's a matinee and an evening show. When you see two guys in their 70s after the Wednesday night show demanding to get notes that night before they go home to go to bed and they have a double day the next day, man, that is commitment. These guys came in every day. They challenged themselves to unearth the deepest truths they could get to about the play. The director, Sean Mathias, did a tremendous job. He knew them really well, which I think was a big advantage. And he'd basically come in most days and say, stop acting. No acting. And what he meant by that was he trusted everybody in that room to have such incredible craft. He wasn't worried if they could pull something off. He wasn't worried if they could, you know, sing the melody that was what he wanted them to discover personally what their connection was to the material and how they related as a group of people to the stories that were being told. They're theater rats, man. I mean, they came in and they just worked really hard. And so it was inspiring. I think it raised the bar for everybody at Berkeley Rep watching them work.
Ian McKellen, for me, was one of the greatest performances I've ever seen on stage.
And so nuanced. So he was doing physical things that required dexterity and stamina. The guy's not a young guy, but he was going for it. And then the way he was able to sort of fold it into the center of both the text and the intention of what he was doing, amazing.
Was there any thought of doing it in Rep like they did in New York with Godot?
No. In fact, No Man's Land benefited from the fact that none of them had ever worked on it before. Patrick and Ian had just done Waiting for Godot for 2 years in England. I was much more interested, frankly, in something where nobody had ever worked on it before because I felt like everyone was starting fresh. They were all kind of coming from the same place of nervous excitement, clean slate, of unknowing, right, which I thought was really, really healthy.
And Mona Golubek's show went to New York.
Mona's show touched people in a way that was very rare. I think the combination of the content, obviously, the story is very moving. Her singular sense of transparency and openness and simplicity and respect for the material, the fact that, you know, she's telling her mother's story, she ended that play saying, you know, this is for mothers everywhere. I mean, it was really impossible not to be really touched by that show.
Hershey Felder, 2 shows this season on Bernstein and Chopin. You brought him back because he'd done Gershwin.
Hershey, you know, directed Mona's show. And in fact, Mona saw Hershey doing his Bernstein show that enabled her to go up to him after she saw it and said, you have to direct my play. And he was like, well, my God, I don't know. I'm overloaded. I got my own stuff. But he was able to do that. And so he came and we thought, well, it would be a good idea if he let off and then he could sort of talk to the audience, which he does amazingly well about Mona's show, that position Mona's show to do well. Then he came here. Hershey's got a very unique talent. I mean, he's a great storyteller. He's a terrific piano player. And he has enormous respect for both the craft and for trying to marry the thrill of being at a musical concert, you know, with the intimacy of telling the audience stories that are both funny and moving. So he's got a very unique style, and I think he's done extremely well with our audience.
Do you plan to bring him back for the Beethoven show at some point?
We haven't talked about that yet. We have so many shows that are going on right now. I mean, it's and plus our Thrust Theater is going to be under renovation for a little while. Next summer, beginning with the summer of 15 through, I think, at least January of 16, the Thrust Theater will be undergoing a major renovation. Not in terms of the architecture of the space, but new seats, new air conditioning, we're trying to upgrade the space. There hasn't been any serious work done on Thrust for, you know, it opened in 1981. That's a long time now. So we need to make sure that that space is a first-rate theater facility.
Let's go back to IHO again for a moment. If there was any flaw to me in IHO, it's that the show kind of petered out during the third act. Mm-hmm. And it might have been because the second act ends so strongly. Mm-hmm. Is Tony done with it?
I think he's done with the major architecture of the play. I mean, I think he will probably publish this version of it. I think he did great work on the structure of it. You know, he restructured the whole play in the sense that different scenes used to end and start each act. And right now, what he did, which was so fabulous, was he combined two scenes to end Act 1 with a scene between Pill and his lover, so that Act 2 is this perfect little circus of an act. It starts with the introduction of a new character who is very funny, and it ends with a wild, now kind of commedia-esque, farcical ending, which is a great topper. Act 3 is a peeling away now of all the sort of external relationships, and so you're just down to the kids and Gus, and I think it has great power that way. I think that there's some issues that he will continue to address, I think, but I think we were really pleased overall with how it shaped out.
Well, I just saw the premiere. Was the final scene supposed to be a fade or a blackout?
I think the final scene is probably the scene that we had the most conversations about Act 3. Because once you do the introduction of how to kill yourself scene, which is so powerful. I mean, we had four medical incidents. During the run of the show, we had four medical incidents where people experienced some sort of trauma where they had to leave the theater after that scene. It was so confrontative in some ways. And Tony had qualms about that. You know, he wasn't trying to induce that in people, but it was the material was so arresting and sort of scary for some people who were dealing with that very issue that I think it was it felt confrontative. But I think the thing that was most successful for me about the work he did in Act 2 is, aside from peeling away these other relationships, and so that all the people who were partners of other people left in Act 2, which is great. And I think he really did great work on the final scene between Gus and his daughter, which really felt like the penultimate scene of the play, which it was always intended to be, and I think he succeeded in that from where I sat. I think the last scene of the play is intended to be an epilogue, and I think what's hard about that is I think a lot of the audience feels like it's supposed to be the summation, and I think that's a problem right now. I think that's an argument that's worth having over the play. It's not intended to be that. It's intended to be like a kind of almost an aftermath.
Like the end of Angels.
Like the end of Angels. You know, Angels, what it did was it broke the fourth wall. Pryor comes out and says, I bless you. He talks you through, and there's a great watershed moment, emotional watershed when he does it. It's a beautiful, spectacular moment. And I really respect Tony's quandary about the dramatic situation of the end of that play, because what are you going to do? Have Gus say, I'm not going to kill myself, or say, you know what, I'm going to wear those razor blades. You know, that either way is a reductive. So having him sort of, you know, paralyzed is right. It feels dramatically right. But the introduction of Eli there and the introduction of what feels like some new ideas but which actually aren't really sort of put an asterisk on the play that I felt like complicated in a way that it didn't need.
Did he think about the idea of having it, the final epilogue be at Gus's funeral?
No. He did not want the audience to know what happened to Gus. And that, I think, was very successful because people ended up arguing a lot
about
what they thought Gus did.
Okay.
I heard the most fantastic theories from people about what they thought happened after the play. I mean, really spectacularly imaginative stuff that I would have never thought of. So I thought that was successful. But if you're going to leave the audience not knowing like that, the rest of it has to be emotionally, I think, really deeply rewarding. And I think that introducing Eli, which theoretically might make sense, was just hard for people to grok around.
Did you try just eliminating the last scene?
No, it was not an option. My job as a director of a new play, and this is a brand new play because he's also rewriting it a lot in rehearsal, is to deliver to the playwright what they've created. Obviously, I'm in dialogue, I'm in deep dialogue with what I think works and what I think doesn't work, and I have an opinion that I express a lot. But end of the day, please play. Do it.
Tony Taccone, one final question. Game on. San Jose rep did it. Anything going to happen with it?
I hope so. A lot of people are interested. It's out of my hands, obviously. But we're talking about three or four, you know, folks who want to do it.
And for you, Tony Taccone, how far ahead are you thinking in terms of Berkeley rep at this point?
About a year and a half. For the 15-16 season, I'd say we're probably halfway booked already. That leaves a bunch of other things. I mean, things can change. They do. They change all the time. But, you know, to secure some of the projects that we want to do, I don't want to book everything too far ahead, though, because things emerge. Things come up. So it's been in our interest for me to keep one or two slots really open until I really have to make a decision. And usually you have to make a decision in, you know, March of the year before that you do them. So there you go.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, the artistic director of Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. An audience with Meow Meow plays through October 19th. For more information, you can go to the website berkeleyrep.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.